For?
A mashal for God's love for the Jewish people. And now that's such a familiar idea that we all think it's, you know, everybody thought that way. But that was not true. There were some people who looked at Shir HaShirim as a literal book, and they said it was not holy. Rabbi Akiva said it was a metaphor. And therefore, every verse about the love of a woman for a man or a man for a woman, and all of the ideas of romantic love, all of that is referring to the passionate love that Hashem has for Am Yisrael and that Am Yisrael has for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And based on that, there's a great poignancy, because you'll recall there are scenes, I don't know if you look at Shir HaShirim or not, many, many people, particularly Hasidim, but even non-Hasidim as well, they read Shir HaShirim every Friday. They read it before Shabbos. Even more people read it after the Pesach Seder. And in Shir HaShirim, there's a point about the woman is in bed and her lover knocks at the door. And the woman plays hard to get. And she says, "Oh, how can I see you? I've already gone to bed." And she's really hoping he'll keep on knocking. But he leaves. And then she realizes that he left. And she goes out looking for him. And she gets beaten up and gets abused. And that's really Kol Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knocks at the door, calling us, beckoning us, wanting to bring the Mashiach. And we're not ready yet. We have our jobs, we have our vacations, like the old story about the person who's about to go to his vacation, first vacation in 50 years, he was going to go to Miami Beach, and Mashiach came. And he was very upset. He said, "You know, you kept us waiting 2,000 years, you couldn't do 2,000 years in 2 weeks, no, after my vacation." And that's how it is, you know, Hashem is ready, and we're not ready. And when we're ready, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, says, you know, now is not the time. You know, that's that kind of that rhythm that goes on. So in Shir HaShirim, there's a very enigmatic verse. And this is what the Gemara in Kesuvos is expounding. Where the woman says, "Hishpati eschem benos Yerushalayim. I make you swear, daughters of Jerusalem." She's speaking to somebody, daughters of Jerusalem. "Im ta'iru v'im ta'oruru es ha'ava. Ad shetechpatz im ta'iru, that you not stir up or not awaken the love until the love arises of its own accord." Don't force the love before it's ready. A very enigmatic pasuk. What type of oath is this? And what's strange enough is this pasuk actually appears 3 times. The third time with a slight variation, but it does appear basically 3 times. So what is this oath? What is this swearing? And what does it mean not to stir up the love until it's desirous? And why does it appear 3 times? I'm just reviewing the Gemara, but I'm giving a little more detail. So the Gemara says, at the time of the destruction of the temple, God imposed 3 oaths on the Jewish people. Now these are spiritual oaths. We don't have any historical record of human beings actually uttering an oath, but God in Shemayim made Klal Yisrael swear. And what are the 3 oaths? So I'm going to mention them in Hebrew, just to be sure that you have the exact words, and then we'll see the interpretation. Oath number 1, Lo Ya'alu Bachoma. They will not go up on the walls. Let's go very literally. Shavuah number 2, Lo yimredu ba'umos. They will not rebel against the nations. And oath number 3, Lo yitchaku es haketz. They will not push for the end. Again, I want to be absolutely literal, so you'll at least know what the words say, and then we'll see how these words are interpreted. And these are 3 oaths that Am Yisrael made. So now let's go over each of these oaths the way Rashi interprets them. At the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now it doesn't say which Beis HaMikdash, actually, the first or the second, but at the time of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, Hashem made Am Yisrael swear 3 oaths. And these are the 3 oaths. Lo Ya'alu Bachoma.
Is this recorded in the Gemara?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is a Gemara in Kesuvos, Kuf Yud Aleph. Right? This is an explicit Gemara in Kesuvos.
And it's in, if it would be First Temple, wouldn't you think that would be quoted in the Mach also?
Not necessarily, no. Because remember, there are many, many traditions about the first Beis HaMikdash that are part of the Torah Shebaal Peh, that are not... not everything that happened is recorded in Tanakh. Chazal have many traditions regarding the first temple as well. Yeah, so Rashi explains the following. Rashi says, oath number one, lo yalu bachoma, you will not climb the walls, is that the Jewish people took an oath that they will not try to regain the land of Israel by force of arms, by military action. They will not try to conquer the land of Israel until the Mashiach comes. They will not try to conquer the land of Israel. We'll come back to this. Oath number two, the Jews will not rebel against the nations of the world, meaning if they're under American rule, they won't rebel against America. They won't rebel against England, so maybe there shouldn't have been Jews in the Revolutionary War or the Russian Revolution. But they will be faithful citizens, in other words. And number three, which may be a little controversial for Chabad, it means they will not try to push the coming of the Mashiach before Am Yisrael is spiritually ready. Now, in a sense, I don't think this is a big problem for the Mifzayim of Mashiach that Chabad does, because the basic emphasis is we bring Mashiach by Masim Tovim, by Avas Yisrael, by loving our fellow Jew. So that's consistent. The Gemara is not condemning praying for the Mashiach. We do that many times a day. The Gemara is not condemning hoping for Mashiach. That's an explicit Gemara, that every single Jew is going to be asked after 120 years, did you eagerly await the coming of Mashiach? So obviously the Gemara is not critical of that. It's not so clear what the Gemara is critical of, but apparently, I think as I mentioned last time, there are mystical ways of forcing Mashiach to come. I don't know those ways, but there are mystical ways of forcing Mashiach to come. But if Mashiach comes before we are ready for it, the light is so great that it would shatter our vessels. We have to make ourselves a kli. We have to make ourselves a vessel to receive the light of Mashiach. Because if chas v'shalom, our vessel is not strong enough, there will once again be a shattering of the vessel. So really, the Gemara is referring to a phenomenon that, you know, the Arizal referred to as shviras hakelim, when the kli cannot hold the ore. I'm sure you're familiar from your other shiurim with this idea. So the three oaths are, do not regain the land of Israel by force, do not rebel against the nations, and do not try to bring the Mashiach by mystical means when spiritually Am Yisrael is not yet ready through Torah, Masim Tovim, Chesed and Avas Yisrael. To put it another way, there's certainly if you're trying to bring Mashiach by Torah, Masim Tovim, Tzedakah, Avas Yisrael, that's a perfectly wonderful thing, and that's what you're supposed to do. Okay. For our purposes, the most controversial of those oaths, the one that gives rise to the greatest machloksim, is oath number one, where we swore we would not try to gain Eretz Yisrael by military action. This is the basis, again I'm reviewing a little bit, this is the basis of the position of Satmir Hasidim and the movement that is called Niturei Karta. Remember Niturei Karta? Niturei Karta are the, well, Niturei Karta is an Aramaic phrase. It just means guardians of the city. The word appears in the Talmud just as guardians of the city, but this is a name that this movement took upon themselves, and they are the fellows who believe that it is forbidden halachically. God forbids a state of Israel, a Jewish state of Israel, until the coming of Mashiach. And their position is, some of them are very extreme. They actually say, give back Israel to the Arabs, give it to the Arabs, and let the Arabs rule, and we're not allowed to rule. And they actually burn the Israeli flag. Not only do they not celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut, but if you go to certain areas of Mea Shearim, they dress in black. Well, they dress in black anyway, but they put out, I don't know how you tell, but they put out actually black cloths and all sorts of things. And I want to emphasize that their opposition to the state of Israel is not because the government is not religious. That's another reason they don't like it. But even if every single member of the Knesset was a religious Jew and a Talmud Chacham and a Tzaddik, they say in principle, based on this Gemara, it is forbidden to have a state of Israel. And the philosophy behind it, what's the philosophy? Like, why did God impose that oath? So their philosophy is that Golos is a punishment on the Jewish people, and it is our job to accept God's punishment until such time as He chooses to redeem us through the coming of Mashiach. And any person that tries to escape God's punishment is committing the sin of what is called Moreid B'Malchus Shamayim. Moreid B'Malchus Shamayim means you are rebelling against the kingdom of heaven. Okay, this is the Neturei Karta, and it's based on this Gemara. This Gemara is so pivotal. This is the Talmudic origin of all of the movements that are against the state of Israel. And they take it, now they take it to a lot of extremes. I mean, they go and they have parties with Ahmadinejad, you know, that's absolutely crazy. But they also believe, based on their philosophy, again, I'm not here to criticize, and I don't agree with them, I can suffice it to say, but I'm not here to criticize, I'm here to describe, just so you know what the belief is. They believe that because of this rebellion against God, that they consider Zionism, that was responsible for a lot of the suffering of the Jewish people. So one person might say, oh, thank God that God gave us the state of Israel in the aftermath of the Holocaust, right? That's how most people look at it, that God gave us a comfort, God gave us a bit of a nechama by giving us a Jewish state after the destruction of so many Jews. Well, Neturei Karta says the opposite. They say it was because of Zionism that there was a Holocaust. They actually take the position that because the Jews rebelled against God by wanting a state, that is why there was such a burden. Again, I'm not here to defend it, and I don't defend it. I think it's absolutely wrong. But I just want to tell you that they do base their teaching on that Gemara. Now, of course, the Gemara doesn't connect it to the Holocaust, but just the naked statement that it is wrong to have a state until the coming of the Mashiach. Now, one important point to remember, the opposition to the state of Israel is not an opposition necessarily to living in Israel. Many members of Neturei Karta live in Eretz Yisrael, and some of them have lived in Eretz Yisrael for hundreds and hundreds of years. So they are not denying the holiness of the land. They are not denying even a mitzvah to live here, although many Neturei Karta don't live here, but some do. I mean, the people in Me'ah Shearim, I mean, not everybody in Me'ah Shearim, but there are many Neturei Karta in Me'ah Shearim. But they do not accept the legitimacy of the government. That means there are Neturei Karta who will not pay taxes. Why doesn't the government arrest them? I don't know, but it's probably too much trouble. You arrest somebody, it'll be a riot and everything else, so sometimes it's not worth the time. Some of them will not even use an Eged bus because it's subsidized by the government. Some of them, if God forbid a member of their family is sick, they will go to Arab hospitals and not to Jewish hospitals, because the Israeli government kind of supports it, right? So there are different levels of this. Others make a chiluk, they make a curious, pragmatic distinction. They don't accept the national government, but they accept the municipal government. They say, well, we can accept the city government, we just don't want the Jews to have a country. So as a result, that allows them to take advantage of garbage collection, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to get rid of their garbage. So, you know, so just like there's conservative and reform Jews, there's also conservative and reform Neturei Karta, meaning there's ultra-Orthodox Neturei Karta, and there's reform Neturei Karta. Again, I mean, in other words, they're reform in terms of they're willing to make certain compromises just to live in this country.
Where do they live besides Israel?
Oh, there's a large group in London and Williamsburg, New York. Williamsburg is adjacent to Crown Heights, but it's a Satmar neighborhood. Yeah. But London has quite a lot of the Neturei Karta. And apparently they have people that are good English writers. If you go to their website, they have websites, and they have people that can write literate English. So apparently they do have secularly educated people that follow them. Now, here, there's one point I want to make. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Just to go back to, I have a question when the Jews entered Israel, were they not told to conquer the land?
Yes, absolutely so, absolutely so. So, historically, no, you're 100% correct. That's why this is only from the Chorban, meaning to say, initially we were certainly commanded to conquer the land, and under Yehoshua, we conquered. But their point is that when Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and exiled us, he now said, your redemption will not occur until Mashiach comes. They're not questioning that initially we were commanded to conquer the land, but they're saying that Golus and Chorban, exile and destruction, is God's punishment upon the Jewish people, and therefore we do not have the right to change it, and if we try to change it, we are what is called Mored, B'malchut Shemayim, we are rebelling against the kingdom of heaven, and that's a tremendous sin, which in their philosophy, again, their philosophy, not my philosophy, in their philosophy, was responsible for much, much suffering. Now, they have almost an alternative view of reality, in which, if we would just accept, they don't want a two-state solution, they want a one-state solution, and the one state is a Palestinian state, not, you know.
Don't they think they'll be killed?
They feel, this is their shita, they feel that if we would not push for our own state, and we would simply give Arabs the whole thing, we would live in peace, they would let us daven, they would let us learn, they would let us serve Hashem, they would let us do all of the mitzvos, and it's only because we want our land as our country that they hate us. This is their philosophy. They actually say that there would be greater peace if there wouldn't be Zionism and there wouldn't be a Jewish state. Now, in truth...
Historically, it's not that.
Yep. Historically what?
Like, nowadays there's tons of terrorist movements. I don't know if it's so possible anymore, but, like, Jews used to live in Arab countries.
Yes, so this is what they point out. They point out, they do point, again, 100% correct. And again, this is not an absolutely insane, this is not an insane position.
No,
historically, you can study, and you could say Jews did live in Arab nations for many, many years, centuries. Now, it's not that they were treated, they were not treated with equality. They were treated very, very poorly, but they survived. You know, they weren't, there wasn't terrorism, there wasn't that a lot of murder, etc. So it is true, it actually is true. It is true that Zionism correlates with the rise of terrorism.
Them to be kicked out of Arab countries.
Well, okay, well, that's right. But you know, as I say, there were many population exchanges. And Jews left Arab countries. Arabs left Israel, and now you know. But yeah,
yeah.
Now I do want to point out that although this will tie into what you said, because you'll see that your point is a good point. That although most people look at Naturei Karta as a bunch of nuts, they look at them frankly, you know, even within the religious Torah world, many people look at Naturei Karta as crazy people. And they are crazy if they go to Ahmadinejad and they say what a tzaddiki is. I mean, you know, the crazy insanity. Some of them have even turned into Holocaust deniers, which is absurd because their own grandparents, you know, were killed in the Holocaust. But I do want to point out, if you turn the clock back to 1920, way before the State of Israel, there were a lot of Orthodox Jews who actually took a very similar position that if the Jews try to have their Jewish state, that's going to create anti-Semitism and the like. This was the position, just to give you a few famous people, this was the position of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, the great leader of German religious orthodoxy. This was the position, I think I may have mentioned, of even the Rebbe Rashab. The Rebbe Rashab, who died before there was a state of Israel, he was Nifter before, but he was not in favor of a Zionist state being founded because he thought it may be a violation of the three Shavuos. So what is Chabad's position, just intellectually, because Chabad, as you know, is a supporter of the state of Israel, and there are Hasidim that go into the army, some do and some don't, but many do go into the army. So the Rebbe's position, once again, is a very pragmatic position. His argument is that even if one were to say that there shouldn't have been a state of Israel, and that may be a philosophically defensible position, once you have a situation where you have 7 million Jews who are living here, you must do whatever you can to protect their security. So to say, oh, let's give it all back to the Arabs and we'll live in peace, you know, that's a fantasy. So it's not that the Rebbe was a Zionist in the sense of supporting a Zionist state. But you have to look at the reality that you face, which means philosophically in the 1920s, many people were closer to the Duritarza than they are today. But now they say what may have been a rational position then has now become a crazy position now, because you have to look at facts in the ground. Remember, this was the Rebbe's same position about not giving back land, right? As all of you know, the Rebbe was very against giving back land for peace. He was against Gaza disengagement. He was against all the way back to the Sinai. But the Rebbe made a very important point. The reason why he's against it is not because land is so important that you risk lives. He said the other way. If giving back land would save Jewish lives, the halacha says saving lives is more important than land. He did not predicate the opposition to giving back land on the sanctity of the land. But he simply said, you're not going to save lives by giving back land. You're going to endanger lives. You're going to bring the enemy closer to the population centers. And in the Arab psychology, when you give up a little, they don't see that as compromise. They see that as weakness. And therefore, they will want more. And again, what can I tell you? All of the bombs that go into Sderot. You know, Sderot is right near the Gaza. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bombs every 5 minutes, every, 2 minutes. Kids have to run into bomb shelters. All of that came from the disengagement, that it brought the enemy so close to the population center, like a mile away, that these things happen. So the point I'm making is that the Rebbe's position regarding the state of Israel is a pragmatic position, meaning to say, it's not that, it's wonderful that there's a Zionist state of Israel. No, there are a lot of problems with the Zionist state of Israel. But Lamaisa, when you have 7 million Jews whose safety depends on there being a state, there being an army, on there being mechanisms that protect us from enemies that want to destroy us, even if we would have preferred that there had been a different arrangement, you have to deal with the facts on the ground and you have to be concerned with Jewish lives. Okay, so it's a little different than, let's say, a Zionist position that saw the state as part of the Messianic process. Okay, now the question becomes, though, the Naturae Carta bases their condemnation of the state of Israel on this oath, do not rebel against the nations. I'm sorry, do not climb up on the wall. What do the rest of the religious Jews do? I mean, most of us accept the state of Israel. Doesn't the Gemara say it's forbidden? So there are two answers to that. And that is, what the oath prohibits is to gain control of Israel by force of arms. That means a war of aggression. If you think about it, modern Israel has never fought a war of aggression. How was the state of Israel created? The state of Israel was not created by war. It's not that we fought to conquer Israel, or Palestine as it was called. What happened was that until World War I, Palestine, I'm going to use the old name, Palestine as it was called, was part of the Ottoman Empire that was ruled from Turkey. After World War I, Palestine became a British mandate. It was controlled by Great Britain. The United Nations passed a resolution in 1947 to which Great Britain acquiesced, authorizing the establishment of a Jewish state. So the state of Israel was not established by military conquest. The state of Israel was established by international agreements. And if we fought wars, they were not offensive wars, they were defensive wars. Because the day that the state was supposed to come into effect was the day that 5 Arab nations attacked us. So the technical argument is, we have not violated any oath of regaining Israel by force of arms, because all military activity that Israel has ever engaged in has been defending ourselves from people who attacked us first. And the state of Israel itself was not established by conquest, unlike the United States, for example. The United States was established by a revolution. Okay, if you're Americans, I apologize for anyone that's not American here. We Americans revolted against Great Britain. Of course, I apologize to anyone that's from England, as it were. Israel was not established by a revolution. Israel was established by an international agreement, and the war was simply a defensive war. That's one answer to why it is not a violation of the oath. And there is a second answer. That is, you have to read the Gemara a little further, that after the Gemara says that God made us swear three oaths, the Gemara says God made a fourth oath on the Umot HaOlam, on the nations of the world. And the fourth oath was, they will not persecute the Jewish people excessively. So it's a package deal.
Same Gemara.
Just keep on going. 111, Ksuvas Kuf Yud Aleph. Fourth oath, Lo Yishabdu BiYisrael Yaiser Midai. So some Mefarshim understand that this is a package deal, meaning we make our promises because they made their promise. But if they break their promise, we're no longer bound by our promise. In other words, the concept was they promised not to treat us badly, so we promise to be subservient to them. But since they broke their oath with crusades and pogroms and certainly the Holocaust, that relieved us of our Shavua as well. So those are two interpretations of why the establishment of the State of Israel would not be a violation of the oath. Either because the wars of Israel were defensive in nature and not offensive, or because we have been released of the Shavua because the Umos HaOlam did not keep their obligations. Yeah.
We were released of all three because they didn't keep.
So according to that Lumdus, that's right, that might be a Chabad defense as well. According to that Lumdus, we would be released of all three, because the understanding is the obligation of the three oaths is conditional on the fourth oath.
So it's not their aggression against our aggression.
Right, it's just simply, it's a package deal. It's as if to say, we made promises in exchange for their promises, and the halacha generally is that if one side, like a contract, if one side does not live up to its deal, that releases you of your obligations under your contract. And even in the case of an oath, it can work that way as well. In fact, by the way, Hashem uses that sometimes too, with the Chedo Ego, right? Hashem promised that we would be his nation. But when we break our promise, Hashem says, I'm no longer bound and I can destroy you, right? That's why Moshe had to pray. That's what Hashem's taina with the Chedo Ego. Hashem could break his covenant because we broke our covenant. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, Baruch Hashem, was mispalel, but Hashem made exactly the same argument that we're making in this context. Okay? So that's kind of the background. And it's good that you know this. This is called the Gemara of the Three Oaths. And it's a famous Gemara. It is the focal point of Neturei Karta Hashkafa and the Zionist enterprise. Now, as you know, the Dati Leumi community, based on Rav Kook, who is a great, great gadol, does take diametrically 180 degree opposite position. They see the founding of a Jewish state as part of the light of Mashiach that comes into the world. And even though it is a secular state, and even if the founding fathers and mothers, like Golda Meir of the State of Israel, did not even believe in Hashem sometimes, but Rav Kook saw this as one of the mysterious ways that Hashem brings Mashiach into the world. So you really have two opposite positions, where some look at Medinat Yisrael as Maaseh Satan, as coming from the Satan and the Sitra Achra, the other side, and the powers of impurity. And others look at it as part of the Tahalich, part of the process of Mashiach. And then many others are in the middle, in which they say, well, we don't consider it messianic per se, but we consider it a chesed that Hashem gave us that we have to appreciate and support. We don't look at it as Mashiach yet. Mashiach has to come in the way Mashiach comes, but we do look at it as a chesed from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So there are like three different views. Maaseh Satan, Maaseh Geula, Aschalta de Geula, beginning of Geula, or Hakara Satov, meaning we can't define it in any particular way, but we can be Makir Tov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yeah.
It might be more of your opinion on the matter, but you know that, for example, with the sin of Adam, where even though it was his choice and he sinned, it was still sort of part of like what was supposed to happen, the same with the temple. So is it the same with the state, that if it really was not supposed to happen, Hashem wouldn't have like brought it into being? Or is that it was totally under our control whether or not he wanted it to happen?
Well, you know, it, without a prophet, without a Navi, it's very, very hard to say. But my feeling, my hergish, and I think many, many people feel this way, is that if it happened, it must have been the Ratzon Hashem in some way.
Yeah.
To bring the Jews back after thousands of years, 2,000 years, to bring them back, to have a kibbutz golios, it is at least a preparation for Mashiach. Now again, maybe we don't use the loaded word, beginning of Geula. That's a very controversial word. It may not be the actual beginning of Geula, but at least it's a preliminary to enable the Geula. So I would not look at it like a Masa Satan. I certainly would not characterize it that way. I think it was part of God's plan. And Rav Kook said, again, I know Rav Kook is a controversial person, but he was a very, very great person, although his philosophy is deep and controversial. Rav Kook had a whole cheshbon that even a secular Zionist who doesn't believe in God, and his whole motivation is just for politics or nationalism or secularism or communism or socialism, whatever the meaning, that's only the external part of his action. But the true motivation is holiness, to be connected to God. He may not identify it as such, but anyone that comes to Eretz Yisrael is coming because of the holiness in their neshama. And Rav Kook said, some people come to Eretz Yisrael because of their connection to Hashem. Others will come to Hashem through their connection to Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, he felt that ultimately, any person that is involved in building up the land, he or his children or his grandchildren, will come back to Hashem, because their connection to Eretz Yisrael will connect them to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This was his mystical view. And he said that if the idea of Mashiach is to gather all the trapped sparks that have not been liberated from the broken vessels, then bedafka, you have to bring in the people that are far from Hashem and get them involved in this spiritual endeavor, and that will bring them close to Hashem. They're like the broken sparks that have not been liberated, and they become liberated through this process. Again, this was Rav Kook's idea. That's why he saw, even in secular Zionism, a great amount of holiness. This was actually one of the main controversies, that even people who were Mechalel Shabbos, and said Rav Kook befriended them, and he respected them, and he encouraged their activities, not the Chilul Shabbos, but he encouraged their activities generally. Other people felt, hey, they're so not only not religious, but they're so anti-Torah, why are you befriending them? But this was his cheshbon. And to this very day, Rav Kook was nifter in the 1930s, and to this very day, he's very controversial in many circles, and he's sometimes not discussed. Okay. Already, so are there any final questions on this? I think that's kind of what I wanted to cover for this particular topic. Okay. Already. So now we're gonna switch gears and talk about a totally different topic. But I wanted to talk a little bit about some aspects of Hilchos Shabbos. Now the one thing that Hilchos Shabbos, some Shabbos problems. Right. You don't look too enthusiastic.
No, we didn't hear you.
Okay. Now, I want to explain one thing. I am not at all going to give you a class in the laws of Shabbos. I'm sure, number one, you have such a class. And number two, that would take, a whole year. I just want to talk about some modern Hilchos Shabbos problems as they apply to technology and time zones. Now, we talk about the international dateline. This will be a slightly different set of problems. First of all, there are three laws of Shabbos I want to introduce to you, one of which you probably know, two of which maybe you don't know. We know, of course, that on Shabbos, you're not allowed to do 39 categories of work. Okay, everyone knows that, and I know that you have all the nice picture books that go through the 39. By the way, there's a new picture book. Do you have that? You use the one...
Yeah.
Yeah, you have the one with drawings, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a very good book, right. That's a great book.
Sure.
No, I know that book. Yes. But there's a new book that someone else did with photographs of these real cute Hasidish kids. So you can check it out. Some people might work easier with photographs than drawings. You know, so it depends on your visual field. But okay. But be this amazed, so you have all the books. You know the 39 Malachos. But there are three laws that you need to superimpose on the 39 Malachos. Law number one is Amira La'ovei Tochavim. The laws about having a non-Jew do work for you. Now, insofar as the Torah is concerned, I could ask a non-Jew to do anything for me I want, because non-Jews are not commanded to keep Shabbos. And not only is a non-Jew not commanded to keep Shabbos, a non-Jew, as you know, is actually not allowed to keep Shabbos totally. You know this halacha. Even if you're a non-Jew that's planning on converting, until you convert, you must desecrate Shabbos at least once every Shabbos. Turn on a light or whatever it is. A non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos 100%. So as far as the Torah is concerned, if I wanted to, I could tell a non-Jew, turn on a light, I could tell a non-Jew, cook for me, I can tell a non-Jew, drive me around, no problem. But rabbinically, the Chachamim prohibited telling a goy to do something for you that you would not be allowed to do for yourself. Okay, any malacha that you are not allowed to do for yourself, unless there's an exception, there are going to be a number of exceptions, you're not allowed to tell a goy to do for you. And this is called Amira La'akum. Akum is an abbreviation for a goy. Amira La'akum Shavus. Shavus means it is a rabbinic prohibition. Now, there are two different laws here. Number one, you're not allowed to tell a goy to do something for you on Shabbos. That's a prohibition to tell him on Shabbos. Now, what if I tell him before Shabbos? In other words, I can't tell a goy on Shabbos, turn on a light for me. Okay. What if I don't tell him on Shabbos? What if I tell him on Friday? By the way, tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, please turn on the light for me. So the halacha is, not only is it forbidden to tell him on Shabbos, but you're not even allowed to tell him before Shabbos to do it on Shabbos. Now why is that so? So the Shulchan Aruch Harav, the Alter Rebbe, actually explains this halacha very well. This is not his chiddush, the halacha is in the Gemara, but he explains the halacha this way. There are two different reasons why the rabbis prohibited telling a guy to do malacha. Reason number one is that on Shabbos you're not allowed to speak about doing work. Meaning, just like I can't even say I'm going to do work after Shabbos, right? On Shabbos there's a prohibition to talk about profane matters. But that would only be a prohibition on Shabbos. But there's another reason why it's usher. Because when a goy does malacha that you asked him to do, he is treated like your shaliach. He is treated like your messenger. He is treated like your agent. And if that's the case, when the agent does something on Shabbos, it's as if I did it. So even if I tell him before Shabbos, even if I tell him a month before Shabbos, hey, on Shabbos, June 12th, turn on the light for me. When he turns on the light, he is your shaliach. So that's for sure. So two cases. You cannot tell the guy to do work for you. You cannot tell him on Shabbos to do work for you. And number two, you cannot tell him before Shabbos to do work for you on Shabbos. Okay. But there's a third law that is less known. Even if you didn't tell him at all, if he did the work for you on Shabbos, you are not allowed to derive benefit from it, even though you didn't say anything at all. Example, if I have, let's say I don't have a, I didn't have set up my Shabbos clock or whatever it is, and it's late in the afternoon or it's already night, and the lights go off, and my nice non-Jewish maid or my nice non-Jewish neighbor simply, for the South Africans, maid, for most of us, neighbor, turns on the light. I didn't ask him to do it. I didn't even hint for him to do it. He did it on his own. I am not allowed to derive benefit from that light. Now, what that means practically is, anything that I wouldn't be able to do without the light, I cannot do. So if, for example, I would be able to read with difficulty, so even though the light makes it easier, I can read in the room. But if I wouldn't have been able to read without that light, I am not allowed to read by that light. So keep in mind that this is nothing to do with whether, and that's why hinting is not going to work either. You can't hint to the guy to turn on the light, because even if he didn't hint and he turned on the light, you couldn't benefit. I mean, obviously, hinting is not going to be better. I'll discuss when hinting might work. But people make a big mistake. People think that it's permitted to hint to a guy, no, it's dark in the room, I can't see. As long as you don't say the words, turn on the light. But no, in a lot of these cases, you will not be allowed to benefit from what the guy does, even if you didn't even hint. So kal vachomer if you hint. I'll discuss why, when hinting would work. Hinting does work in a certain category of cases, but in a lot of cases it does not. So be sure you understand there is a separate rabbinic law. You cannot derive benefit if the guy did it for you. Now, this is very important. The prohibition of benefit is only if the guy only did it for you. If the guy also did it for himself, let's say your maid turned on the light so she could see something, then as long as you didn't ask her to turn it on, you can benefit. And you could even ask her, please don't turn it off. There's nothing wrong with that. If she turned it on for herself, you can then say, okay, please don't turn it off, because there's nothing wrong with that, okay? So that's very important. If the guy did it only for you, you are not allowed to derive benefit. If the guy did it for himself and you, you are allowed to derive benefit, but you're still not allowed to ask him to do it, but you can benefit after the fact. Yeah.
If the guy did it with both of you in mind, so for her, like herself and for you,
that's fine.
It's fine.
Yeah, you can't ask him, but you can benefit. In fact, yeah.
Let's say he came in and turned on the light, and it was like darkish, and it was like, I don't know, 8 p.m. and it was like kind of hard to see, and then later.
Yep.
So it would have been impossible to see with the lights already on.
Yes, so then you can't, you have to leave the room.
You have to follow like the natural.
Yes. Now, let me give you an example where hinting would work. Let's say my dining room is dark. My dining room is dark, or my kitchen is dark. I cannot ask the guy to turn on a light. I can't even hint to the guy, oh, it's dark, because I would be benefiting. But this is what I can do. I can tell the guy, oh, in the dining room or in the kitchen, there's a great piece of herring and some good schnapps. Would you like to have herring and schnapps? This tended to work more in Poland maybe than, right? Okay? So, the guy comes in and he says, gee, it's dark in here. He turns on the light, but now he's not turning on the light to do you a favor. He's turning on the light so he could find the herring and the schnapps. In that case, you're still not allowed to say, please turn on the light. You absolutely cannot do that. But you've converted the turning on the light not just for your benefit, but also for his benefit. At that point, you're allowed. So that's where hinting comes in. Hinting doesn't just mean you tell the guy, oh, it's dark and I can't see, because that would just mean he's turning on the light for you. But if you create a benefit for him, then at that point, that would be much, right? That's how, yeah.
It's like the same thing, because you're just like, you're in your mind, you want the light to be.
No, it is very true. Of course,
why go through all those wording? Why don't you just say, if it's okay to like.
well,
in that sense, it should just be okay.
Yeah, I understand. Now, remember, you know, you're certainly not dealing with a Torah violation here, because even if I were to tell the guy to turn on the light, you're not violating the 39 malachos, that's for sure. You're dealing with rabbinic prohibition, so the rabbis wanted to be sure that you don't take advantage of indiscriminately asking goyim to do all sorts of things for you. So they did require that you have a certain ritual, and that way you're less likely to do it that often. After all, you don't want to use up all your herring and schnapps all the time. So these types of rituals, I understand that they seem a little superficial, but they're designed to create a mindset where you don't indiscriminately use non-Jews to do all of your work for you. Okay, now let me just mention there are a lot of exceptions to these rules. First of all, let me mention a few things. I'm not going to mention everything. Rule number one: in cases of sickness, even if it's non-life-threatening, if it's life-threatening, you can do everything. You can tell a guy to help you, meaning to say the following: if I have the flu, non-life-threatening, I just have the flu, I could ask a non-Jew to drive to the drugstore and pick up medicine for me. I don't have to hint, I don't have to give him schnapps, I can just say, could you please pick up the medicine? Because since Amira Lovet Kochavim is only a rabbinic law, the rabbis did not impose it in the case of illness. Same thing if your child has a cold or whatever. Now, when I say illness, I don't mean every minor headache, but if it's an illness where someone is bedridden, so you can tell a guy, right? That's exception number one. Exception number two, and this is a little controversial, is based on this idea, you can always tell a guy directly, I don't mean hinting, to fix, either turn on or fix heat in a dira. Let's say it's the winter, it's cold, it's raining, and my heat either shuts off because of a Shabbos clock, or it's broken. I can actually have a guy turn on the heating, and I can have the guy even repair the heating on Shabbos. I don't have to hint, I don't have to give him schnapps, I can ask him directly. And this is actually based on the principle that in the absence of heat, many people will get sick. And therefore, the same principle that says I can tell a guy to do work in the case of illness will also apply to repairing heat, because hakol cholin, everyone is potentially sick when it's too cold.
In the,
So now the interesting question is: okay, this is the right. So that law is not controversial. Fixing heating is not controversial. It's a dover pasha that heating systems can be repaired on Shabbos by a guy, because potentially people would be sick. The big interesting question is, what about air conditioning? What about the other way around, where your air conditioning conks out on Shabbos? Either your Shabbos clock shuts it off, or the system just breaks down. Can I have a guy, again, without hinting, can I have a guy repair air conditioning on Shabbos? So this is a big machlokas. Some opinions say that, hey, when it's cold, you're likely to get sick, but when it's too hot, you're going to be very uncomfortable, but you probably won't get sick. Meaning to say, the idea that the heter is because of potential sickness is a stronger argument when it's cold than when it's too hot. Other people are makel. Other people say, hey, you know, actually, I'm very sympathetic to the view, because I much more suffer from the heat than from the cold. So, but nevertheless, I don't want my personal feelings to change the halacha here. But I like the poskim that permit the fixing of air conditioning because of that. But that's a big machlokas. You have to ask your rabbi if it comes up. I will say, as a declaration against my own self-interest, that the better reasoned halachic position is that you should not be able to fix the air conditioning. That I think there is a difference. I think that a house without heat can easily bring people sickness. A house without air conditioning is less likely to create a sickness. Okay, so I mentioned so far two categories of heter, which really overlap. One is sickness, and the other is heat. And then we have a machlokas about air conditioning. Now, there is a third heter, which overlaps a lot, and that is Tzorchei Rabim. Tzorchei Rabim is when it is a communal need for a large group of people, not just a private family. An example would be a shul. Let's say you have a shul, and it's Friday night, and the shul is totally dark. It's totally dark. Nobody can daven, or a lot of people can't daven if they don't know they're davening by heart. Now, for me to ask a guy to turn on a light in my house would normally be prohibited, but some say if it's for a mitzvah that involves many people, like a Beis Knesses, they will permit you to tell a guy, or at least hint to the guy by saying it's dark, even if the guy doesn't get schnapps or anything. Now, because of that reason, that impacts on air conditioning. Even the opinions that will not allow me to tell a guy to repair my air conditioner in my apartment, they will allow me to have a guy repair the air conditioning in the shul. Not because of the air conditioning exception, but because of the Tzorche Rabim exception. Again, these are complicated laws. I'm just giving you a general overview.
Can you ask directly, or do you still have to?
It is better to hint, just to say. And the way you hint is you basically describe the situation. You basically say, our air conditioner has conked out, and we are not allowed to fix it. And then the guy says, what do you want me to do? So you say, well, do what you want, but our air conditioning is out and we're not allowed to fix it. Okay. And you hope you have a smart guy that figures this out. But again, I do want to point out that you cannot do that for your own home. In your own home, you have to actually make it that the guy gets some benefit from it.
Could you say he's benefiting from the light?
Well, unless he's going to...
So do you feel it's dark here? We can't turn on the lights.
Well, if he's not planning on staying, that wouldn't be called benefit. In other words, if he's going to read, if he's going to give him a newspaper, that could be so. But if he's not in the shul, he's only coming into the shul for you, so we really wouldn't call him benefiting from the light under those circumstances. Okay. All right, so now another example where things are problematical. Let's take, this may have happened to you, the old story about the refrigerator. Let's talk about that for a moment generally. Right? The old refrigerators, even the new refrigerators, generally have a light that turns on when you open the refrigerator. Okay? Now obviously on Shabbos you're not allowed to turn on electric lights. So what every person has to do before Shabbos is you have to unscrew or disable the light bulb from turning on so you don't activate the light on Shabbos. Okay. So what's the halacha generally if I forgot to unscrew the light bulb? And if I open the refrigerator, the light's going to turn on, and if I close the refrigerator, the light's going to turn off. So what do I do?
You don't open.
That's correct. So you're not allowed to open it, even though that means you don't have food for Shabbos, right? But you can't open it. But the question is, can I ask a guy to open the refrigerator for me? Meaning, am I allowed to tell a guy or ask a guy to open the refrigerator? And if I am, do I have to hint? Do I have to offer him food? Right? What do I exactly do? So many opinions say the following idea. If you really don't have a Shabbos meal, unless you get access to the food in the refrigerator, in other words, you don't have a basic Shabbos meal. You don't have your challah. You don't have chicken. You don't have a basic meal. So then you can actually ask the guy explicitly to open the refrigerator. You actually can't tell him. You cannot tell him to close it, because that's a malacha too. But hopefully he'll just close it on his own. But what if your basic food you have, but it has your banana cream pie and your rugelach and everything else, you know, from what's that place, marzipan, right? you've been to marzipan? I have not been, but everyone tells marzipan you have to go to marzipan. But okay, so let's say you just want to get your desserts, your extra good stuff. So here you're not allowed to ask the guy to open up directly. Therefore, you have to do the hinting and you have to offer him some food. You have to make it so that he is opening it for himself. Right? So the bottom line is, you're able to get the guy to open it one way or the other. But if your basic meal is in the refrigerator, you ask him directly. If it's not your basic meal, you have to hint and give him something as well. What do you do if there's no guy around? You know, you're really in trouble. If there's no guy around, it is a big problem. But some actually say the following Eitzah. Some give you this Eitzah. And again, I'm not... Well, some say like this. Some say that you are allowed to unplug the refrigerator while the compressor is not being activated. Right? You know how a refrigerator works. When you open a refrigerator, warm air comes into the refrigerator, and that triggers a thermostat, and then the compressor starts cooling the system. And when the refrigerator reaches a certain temperature of coldness, the compressor shuts off. Right? That's why you hear a noise, it stops and starts, stops and starts. Now, when it's off, there is no electricity running through the system. So when you're unplugging a refrigerator that's closed and the compressor is not operating, you are simply unplugging an appliance that's off, like a lamp that's off. So what, therefore, some people say you can do is be sure that the compressor is not operating, meaning the appliance is off, and then you can unplug it, but it's muksa, so you have to unplug it with your elbow. And at that point, by unplugging the appliance when the door was closed, you didn't turn off any light because the light was off. You would then be allowed to open and close the refrigerator door, and as long as you don't open it too long, it'll remain cold for a long time. So even though that means you'll have an unplugged refrigerator for the rest of Shabbos, but you know, depending on when that is, that may be okay. So that may be an Eitzah, even without a Goy, but I do want to warn you, this only works for old-fashioned refrigerators. It doesn't work for new refrigerators. So if you have a 1960s refrigerator, you're fine. And the reason is the following. In the old refrigerators, when the compressor was running, there was a motor, and when it stopped running, it was just off. It was like a lamp that was turned off. Nothing was happening. So when you unplugged it, it's like unplugging a lamp whose light is off. Today, that's not the case, because you have so much digital readouts and all sorts of internal things and lights inside. Besides the light bulb, there are actually lights within the system. So when you unplug even a closed refrigerator where the compressor is not running, you are disconnecting a lot of electrical circuitry that is operating. So this Eitzah, you have to be very careful about your model. So this Eitzah that I'm telling you, that you are permitted to unplug a refrigerator when the compressor is not working, may not work for modern models. So you have to be very, very careful that you understand how your model works. For that matter, even if you unscrew the light bulb, you may not be able to open these modern refrigerators because they're digital readouts. Right? I don't know if any of you, maybe your parents have these refrigerators that have digital readouts. It tells you what the temperature is, right? So when the refrigerator door is closed, it'll say 55. You open the door, it'll turn into 58. You close the door, down to 55. You simply cannot open those refrigerators on Shabbos at all. Because every time you open and close, you are changing the digits electronically. And you're violating the laws against completing electric circuits and the like. So the modern technology of appliances makes it very difficult for a Shomer Shabbos. You need to find ways of disabling all of these mechanisms. And there are engineers whose specialty is to make Shabbos-compliant appliances. It's a whole little sub-industry that one needs to be aware of.
That's a new deal with the Shabbos.
The Shabbos, the kosher switch, it's called. Right, yeah.
I have one question.
I'll talk about that.
Okay.
Is that another question?
When you have a situation, let's say if the light didn't get turned off in the fridge before Shabbos, and then you, let's say your meal is there, so you ask a non-Jew to open it?
Yes.
Can you like hint to him to disable the light while he's in there?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you can. Well, the only question is, I'm thinking it's a little difficult because in order for you to hint to disable, he has to get some benefit. Now, it's hard to know what benefit he gets from disabling. He gets benefit from turning on a light because he could see better.
He could come back for a snack.
With extra cake.
Yeah, if he comes back in an hour, he gets another snack.
The benefit cannot be because you promise him something because he does a malacha. The benefit has to be from the malacha itself. He gets a benefit. So I think that would be difficult. Unplugging. Yeah.
I'm wondering, look at his nails. How this works with, like, let's say girls light candles.
Yep.
could they then go tell even a Jewish man or non-Jews to...
Okay, okay. Excellent, excellent question. Let me address this generally. We know that when women light candles, they generally, unless they specifically stipulate that they're not, they generally accept Shabbos early, right? You accept Shabbos with hadlakas haneros. That's why you don't even blow out the match, right? You put the match down, it goes out by itself because you're not allowed to blow out the match. Now, in most places, we light candles between 18 and 20 minutes before sunset. Some 18, some 20. The minhag of Yerushalayim, as you know, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, is we try to light candles 40 minutes before sunset. Right? This is a unique minhag of Yerushalayim. So the question becomes, I'm just repeating your question, if a woman lights candles early, not early, she lights on time, but she accepts Shabbos early, therefore, because Shabbos doesn't start until sunset, is she allowed to ask a goy to do work for her? Is she allowed to ask a Jew to do work for her, right? The Jew, right? My wife lights candles. I didn't accept Shabbos yet. Can I turn on lights on the light? So this is very important. There are more rules that even if you accepted Shabbos early, you are allowed not only to ask a goy to do work for you, you can even ask a Jew to do work for you.
Ask directly?
Directly. No need to hint and the like. You are permitted to instruct a non-Jew after accepting early Shabbos, and you can even instruct a Jew. Rav Moshe has one exception. Rav Moshe says if a husband has accepted Shabbos before his wife, he should not ask his wife to do malacha for him. But vice versa is okay. A wife could ask her husband.
Why?
See, well, okay, this is a little hard to explain. Rav Moshe points out that you're not allowed to ask your slave to do malacha for you. Rav Moshe says that. Okay. He basically develops the cheshbon that when it comes to domestic responsibilities, the woman would have the status of an eved for those purposes. Okay, but okay, that's a talk for another time. But okay, but again, I just want to clarify that this can happen in two scenarios. A woman lights candles, and her husband hasn't yet been mekabel Shabbos. But it can also happen the opposite way. You know, in the States, not so much in Israel, but in the States, it's very common in the summer that many synagogues have early Shabbos minyan. Let's say, right, sunset is like 8 o'clock. But if you have little kids, you don't want to go to shul at 8 o'clock and then start the meal 9 o'clock or 9:30. So many synagogues have an early Shabbos minyan. So instead of davening, so sunset is 8, but they'll daven at 6:30 or 7. So the husband's already going to shul at 6:30 or 7, and by the he'll probably reach Kabbalah Shabbos, let's say, by 7. But his wife doesn't want to light until lichtpenching. So there you have a reverse question. Can she do work? So that's where Rav Moshe says the husband should not ask her to do work for him, but she could do work for herself. She's not bound. See, that's interesting. She's not bound by her husband's early Shabbos. And even though normally a woman has to follow the customs of the husband, but Rav Moshe says that is only if it was done for religious reasons. But the early Shabbos is not for religious reasons. The early Shabbos is for convenience reasons. And therefore, the wife is not bound. Did you want to ask something?
Yeah, I had a question about the light, since you can't blow out matches.
Yes.
If you have one of those lighters, I guess, are you not allowed to use that? Because then when you take your finger off it, it turns out the light?
Yeah, I think there would be a little bit of a problem. The best thing to do to use that is that you can use it to light the match, and then when you make the bracha, you put down the match. In other words, you shouldn't use something that you're going to have to extinguish after you lit the Shabbos candles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a Chabad house, and my father would bring in Shabbos early.
Yes.
And then my father always stops before Maariv to make sure that we have lit candles.
Mm-hmm. That's very good. That's fine. Of course, that would mean you're not going to have the dilemma. In other words, by the time...
It's not necessary?
Well, this is what Rav Moshe says. Again, the big machlokas... Okay, let me explain the machlokas. As a general principle, you'll see the problem. As a general principle, a wife is supposed to follow the customs of her husband. So So you might think, therefore, if the husband accepted Shabbos early, the wife would have to accept Shabbos early. So that's apparently how your father follows. So some opinions will say that. Some opinions will say that the wife must accept Shabbos no later than the husband. Rav Moshe Feinstein, however, did have a leniency. So not everyone agreed. Rav Moshe Feinstein's leniency was that since early Shabbos is convenience and not religious reasons, so a wife is not bound. But still, I mean, there are other opinions, so what your father is doing is certainly following. Where is his Chabad house? Where is it?
Australia.
Ah, okay, very good. Yeah, do you have another question?
Yeah. Aside from the whole, like, husband-wife issue, I thought that if a community, like, aside from individual, but if a community accepts upon itself to take in Shabbos early,
yep,
that's binding to all, yep, members.
Yeah, very excellent. You're raising all good questions here. There are two different issues. There's husband-wife issue, and there's community issue. It is 100% the case that if a community has accepted Shabbos early, you are bound by that acceptance. However, it is very, very rare that that's going to apply. And the reason is because even the shuls that have early minyans usually have late minyans, and there's more than one shul. So theoretically, you are correct. If there's only one shul in a community, and that shul only has an early minyan, then you have to have Shabbos early. You don't have a choice. Even if you decide, or your husband decides, I'm not going to shul, I'll daven at home, you are bound. But in the real world, you cannot never have that scenario.
It's like that where I live.
Huh?
It's like that where I live.
Only one shul? With only
there's
one minyan?
There's a conservative shul, and then there's a Chabad house.
And they only have
Chabad
one minyan.
Chabad house takes in Shabbos early.
Okay. Okay. So there you have it. Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up. In other words, that is important. Again, I'm used to a lot of shuls, but yeah, you're right. If there's only one place, and they take on Shabbos early, and there is not a second minyan, then every Jew who is there for Shabbos must start Shabbos as early as that minyan starts Shabbos. You don't have a choice. It makes no difference. Husband, wife, it makes no difference. But I'm referring to a scenario where because there's more than one shul, or even if there is only one shul, there's more than one minyan. So if there's an early minyan and a late minyan, so the early minyan does not obligate the latecomers. So under those circumstances, you are not bound by the early minyan, and it's only going to be a question of husband-wife, and that's what we have for Moshe's Shita, that the wife is not bound to the husband because this is a convenience minhag, and other people will argue. Right? So that's important to be aware of. In fact, I'll tell you, I remember when I was in yeshiva, this was a real shaila, my yeshiva was in Baltimore. And in our single days, people would often go to New York to meet prospective shiduchim. So they'd want to leave early because Baltimore to New York is a three-hour drive, right? Kind of a late date. I never went to New York Saturday night that way. So what they would want to do is they would want to have an earlier minyan Shabbos night. So instead of waiting 72 minutes, Rabbeinu Tam Shita, they would wait 45 minutes so they could go to New York earlier, a little earlier. And the Rosh Yeshiva said that it's absolutely forbidden. And the reason it's forbidden is if the official congregation, it's the same thing at the end of Shabbos as the beginning, if the official congregation, and there's only one official congregation, does not end Shabbos until 72 minutes, then you are bound by the congregation, even if halachically you could have ended Shabbos earlier. And the same principle that says you are bound by an early Shabbos if there's only one kahal, also says you are bound by a late Shabbos if there's only one kahal. So he said it was chilul Shabbos for people to leave early. Yeah.
And also bound by what you generally keep.
I didn't hear you.
And also bound by what you generally keep.
In other words, if you normally keep 72 minutes, are you allowed to? Yeah, you are bound because the general rule in halacha is that if you took on a certain stringency and you did it three times. It becomes like a vow, it becomes like a neder. You can go to a beis din, have hataras nedarim to release you from your vow, but normally you are pretty much bound. You can't like switch your minhag every week. Oh, this week I'll do 45 minutes, next week I'll do 72 minutes. It becomes a part of your chiyuv. Yeah. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But there's a simple eitzah that whenever you bring Shabbos in early, you should always say, I am doing this b'li neder. If you say you're doing it b'li neder, then you're not bound. You could switch. Otherwise, it becomes like a vow. Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's very good to always think, whenever you take on a new chumrah, you should always say, I am taking this on b'li neder, without the intention that it should become a vow. Some people do this for Chalav Yisrael. Now, I know that in Chabad, we treat Chalav Yisrael as a very, very strict halakha. Other people are more lenient, but they try to keep Chalav Yisrael. That means only milk that was supervised by a Jew. But if they feel they're going to be in places where that milk will not be available, so they're advised that when they take on this din, they should have kavana that they're doing it b'li neder. But I know that you keep Chalav Yisrael no matter what the conditions say, so that it wouldn't be relevant for you. Okay, Annie, were there any other questions about...
Yeah. So just a quick one. How do you daven Maariv before the sun is set?
Oh, okay, you're asking in general. I mean, not just in Shabbat. All the time. Yeah. This is a very excellent, interesting question. And the short answer is, strangely enough, you can actually daven Maariv before the sun sets. You can daven Maariv within an hour and a quarter before sunset.
Hour and 15 minutes
before sunset. Now, when I say that, I mean relative hours. Do you know the concept of what's called a halachic hour? It's a complicated concept. That is, a halachic hour is not 60 minutes. It's 1/12th of the daylight period. So, for example, in the summer, where sunrise to sunset might be 14 hours, a halachic hour might be 75 minutes. In the winter, where from sunrise to sunset might be 10 hours, a halachic hour might only be 45 minutes. My numbers are not exact, but you get the idea. So, in an equinox day, where you have exactly 12 hours, a halachic hour is 60 minutes. 12 hours. So, whenever I say any measurement in hours, we always mean halachic hours. So that would mean, in the summer, you can actually daven Maariv almost 2 hours before sunset. In the winter, you can daven Maariv, let's say, 45 minutes before sunset. The principle is the same. It's an hour and a quarter of a halachic hour, which is 1/12th of daylight hours. The term for that is Sha'os Zamanios. Sha'os Zamanios means hours that depend on the time of year. Same thing for Shema. Everything's that way. The Shema has to be recited the first 3 hours of the day. But that doesn't mean 180 minutes after sunrise. It refers to 1/4 of the daylight hours. Now, one thing about Maariv, though, you can daven Maariv an hour and a quarter before sunset, but for men who have to say the Shema, they would have to repeat the Shema, because the Shema can only be recited at night. Maariv, you could be Yotzei early, but the Shema must be recited again at night.
Is that early because when you say 1 hour and 15 minutes, is that halachic hours still, or our hours translated because of the halachic hours?
No. 1 hour and 15 minutes means 1 1/4 halachic hours. So that could be more than an hour and 15 or less than an hour and 15.
But how come? Like, why?
Well, that period is called Polag HaMincha. Polag HaMincha means the second half of the afternoon, the latter half of the afternoon. And that's based on the idea that for many, many purposes, we already treat it like the next day. Now, not for Shabbos. Shabbos doesn't begin then. But for example, you can light candles that early. When can you... I want to be Mekabel Shabbos early. How early can I be Mekabel Shabbos? Can I make Shabbos on Wednesday? Can I say, okay, I want Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I want four... Can I make Shabbos on Sunday? I want a week of Shabbos. How early can I accept Shabbos? Answer, an hour and a quarter before sunset. Halachic hours. So, in a lot of ways, Plag HaMincha, you have the permission to treat it like the next day, so we allow that for Maariv as well, but not for Shema. Shema you have to. Now Shema is not such a problem for women, because technically women are not obligated in the recitation of the Shema, so they don't have to worry about it, but it would be an issue of counting the Omer, if you count the Omer, because women are not chayav either, but many women count the Omer, that if you're davening Maariv early Friday night, you would not count the Omer until nightfall. So certain things are nightfall, and certain things, like the Tefillah of Arvis, that can be early. Now, here, let me raise an interesting question about time zones. This is not going to be international dateline, but a very simple question. Let's say I have a business, and I have a business in New York, and I want to call my employee. Let's say Shabbos is over here, right? Saturday night. So Shabbos is over 9 o'clock at night, right? That's when it was over last night. Now, in New York, what time is it when it's 9 o'clock at night here?
1 or 2.
It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon in New York. Can I call? Now, I certainly cannot call a Jewish person in New York because I'm causing them to desecrate Shabbos. I can't call my mother or my cousin in New York to talk to them because even though it's not Shabbos for me, it's Shabbos for them, and I'm causing them to do an Aveira. Right? That's simple, right? You understand that. You cannot call your non-religious relative on Shabbos. And even if they call you, you really shouldn't answer. They should know not to call you. But the question is, can I call a non-Jew in New York either to talk socially as a friend or even to ask him, hey, could you fix this machine for me in New York, or let's say he works for me. So this is very interesting. Even though you're not allowed to tell a non-Jew to do work for you on Shabbos, if it's not Shabbos where he is, even though it's Shabbos where you are, you are. The reverse. Let me be sure I have this right. Nope. I'm sorry. I misstated. You cannot. Meaning, you have to look at where the non-Jew is. I'm sorry. That's correct. Meaning to say, if it is Shabbos where the non-Jew is, you are not allowed to tell him to do work for you, even though it's not Shabbos where you are. Okay, I'm sorry, I misspoke, okay? Meaning to say, I am talking to the non-Jew when it's not Shabbos for me. And I am telling him to do stuff for me where it is Shabbos where he is. So under those circumstances, since he is doing something for you at a time when it is Shabbos where he is, you are not allowed to ask him to do that.
It's not Shabbos for you.
But remember, like the Alter Rebbe explains, when a goy does malacha for you, he is acting as your shaliach. So in effect, I have a shaliach who is doing something where it's Shabbos. So it's treated like my sin. He's like my long hand. It's as if I have a long arm reaching out to New York, right? And I'm turning on a light in New York. Imagine, it's a crazy case. I'm in Israel, but my arm reaches all the way to New York, right? Long arm, longer than Bas Pyro's arm when she rescued Moshe, right? 5,000 mile arm. And I switched on a light switch. That would be forbidden because I switched on the light switch in New York. Now, the other way around, one second, is the following. Let me give you a reverse hypothetical. Okay, everyone understand this. And that is, what if I tell the non-Jew before it's Shabbos for him or for me, I tell the non-Jew that I want you on Saturday, 3 p.m. in New York, I want you to fix this computer system for me. In other words, I'm telling him to do something. I'm sorry, these hypotheticals are hard. Yeah, yeah.
No.
We want to do it the other way. We want to create a case. In other words, the case where it's usher is where it's Shabbos where he is, and it's not Shabbos where I am. It's usher.
You can say Friday afternoon.
But what about it's Shabbos for me, and it's not Shabbos for him? So the example would be, Right.
Friday
I tell him, 2 o'clock Friday afternoon, I want you to fix the computer system in New York.
I'm telling him before.
I'm telling him before. But he's fixing it when it's already Shabbos for me. He's fixing my computer in New York, 2 o'clock Friday afternoon, when it's already Shabbos for me. That's going to be permitted. Because the point is the same symmetry in both sides of the case. Meaning to say, we don't look at where you are, we look at where the goy is when he's doing the prohibited activity. If the goy is doing the prohibited activity when it is Shabbos, it is usher even if I told him before or after Shabbos. When the goy is doing the prohibited activity, it's not Shabbos in New York, even if it's Shabbos for me in Israel, because I told him before, it is permitted, okay? So you're not looking at where you are, you're looking at where the goy is. Yeah?
Am I allowed to look at news that's written in Israel on Shabbat, like after Shabbat, or when I'm to know?
Where are you?
Well, if it's after Shabbat, then I'm in Israel, or it could be out of Israel when I'm...
So let's say it's already Shabbat in Israel and you're looking at the news in Israel.
Yeah.
It would be better not to, actually, but the heter that you would have is the following. The heter that you would have actually is that, well, it's a little complicated because you're raising a variation. See, the problem of the news is not benefiting from what a non-Jew did for you, it's benefiting from what Jews probably did. And that's actually more chumer. I was going to say, if it's only non-Jewish journalists, then since they're also doing it for non-Jews, they're doing it for Jews and non-Jews, you're allowed to benefit. But when it's a Jewish company that did it, then you really shouldn't benefit at all. You see the difference? So I think with Israeli companies, you'd have to assume that these are Jewish companies that are putting out this information. So you'd be stricter. You know, once it's Shabbat in Israel, you should not benefit from it till afterwards. But if it's a non-Jewish company, they're doing it also for non-Jews and the like. Okay, so again, there's some more issues we'll discuss. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. It's a very different case, but say there's 2 days Yom Tov, like Shavuot or something.
Right.
So in Israel, it's only one day.
Yes.
Could you get on a plane right after Shavuot and go to New York and land, and then you land on the second day Shavuot in New York?
Yeah. This is a very, very excellent question, a very practical question. First of all, it depends on the psak that you have. In other words, you're assuming that you in Israel only have to keep one day.
Or an Israeli.
Okay. Whether an American in Israel would keep one day or not, that's a big machlokes. But let's say you're an Israeli. An Israeli keeps one day. So for an Israeli to go drive to the airport, for an Israeli to get on a plane on the second day of Shavuos, no problem, because it's not Yom Tov. The problem is, of course, that the Israeli is going to land in Chutz La'aretz when even an Israeli is obligated halachically to keep 2 days of Yom Tov. Huh?
Really?
Yes, absolutely. It's a mistake. An Israeli who comes to Chutz La'aretz must keep... He davens a weekday davening, but he's not allowed to do malacha. So this
in
is
public
a...
Public or in private as
well? So in public for sure. And in private, most opinions say even in private cannot do malacha. Some people are makel in private, but in public, absolutely. So some people permit the following. Some people say that he is allowed to land in the airport because since he is far from a Jewish community, it is not called a public desecration, but that's not so pleasant. That would mean he would not be allowed to enter the Jewish community on Yom Tov. Because that would be a public desecration of Yom Tov, which would not be permitted. You see? So some people would say that the problem is not in the landing in the airport. The problem is the taxi that would take him to the Jewish community. Other people are makel because they say when he left with permission. He didn't do an Aveira, so he's not subject to the Yom Tov Sheni laws until he actually arrives at his host's destination. But all in all, it would be much better not to do this because it is questionable, and it's not at all pashut that he's allowed to take a cab to his destination. He might be forced to spend the rest of Yom Tov in the airport, which is not the greatest thing.
Like going to Eilat the day after. That's the same thing.
It would be the same. It would be the same thing, assuming that in Eilat you only keep. No, I'm saying going to Eilat.
Yeah.
No, Eilat they keep. They keep one. Yeah. No, Eilat they keep two. I'm sorry, Eilat they keep two. That's right. Eilat most keep two.
Is Eilat not considered in?
That's the issue. Many opinions say Eilat is not considered Israel halachically, and as a result, Eilat should keep 2 days. Maybe it was Hashem's way to keep people away from Eilat. It's good. You know, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, Eilat is Mi'ikarad in 2 days.
So
that's
good. It
would be the same halachic shayla. So you shouldn't do it. So again, it's a very, very interesting question. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll continue with some of these variations next week.
Yeah.